Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're going to turn our attention right now to the art world, more specifically the world of art forgeries. It is a much bigger business than you might imagine, and we're going to spend some time talking about one of the great series of forgeries that took place that fooled dealers, galleries, museums. To share this story with us, we are joined by my guest, Lainey Salisbury. She was a reporter. She worked for Reuters and the Associated Press, reporting from Africa, the Middle East, and New York. She's the co-author of The Cruelest Mile, which is being made into a major motion picture, and her newest book is Providence, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. Lainey Salisbury, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How rare are forgeries and con jobs in the art world?
Well, that was one of my surprises during research for, you know, that was one of my surprises while researching the book, is that forgeries actually are quite common in the art market. Some experts believe that about 40% of the artwork out there is misattributed in some way. Some might be direct forgeries. People know that they're fakes and they sell them. It might be a painting that doesn't have a signature on it but is genuine, and someone adds a signature to it to make it more valuable. A restorer might add something into a painting, either a certain color or a symbol or a figure, to make the painting more valuable. Or it just might be honestly misattributed.
Has modern technology made it easier to discover these forgeries?
It's made it easier, but it's quite expensive to use, and it often requires taking a paint sample off the work, and not many people want to do that when they've just paid $140 million for an artwork.
Right. But on the other hand, people would like to know before they pay the $140 million what its authenticity is.
Right, and that's where the experts come in, and the scholarships, and the art historians. There are many scholars out there whose sole job is to look at a painting and to give the painting its a certificate of authenticity. Usually that's the estate of the artist. It could be the artist's son or daughter or wife or husband. And they'll put their, basically, it's pretty much like a stamp of approval on the back of the painting. And there are also dealers out there who are experts in one or two artists, and their word means a lot. But these people sometimes get it wrong. And it doesn't mean that they're bad at what they do. It just means that there are actually a lot of good forgers out there.
Talk about that, the quality of the forgery that's out there, and how that should be viewed in the context of the art world, because certainly the quality of the forgery in many respects seems like an art form unto itself.
In a way, yes. I mean, some people look at forgeries in a sort of a snobbish way. I mean, they're déclassé. They're not the original, therefore they aren't worth much. But some people can look at a forgery and say, wow, this is a beautiful recreation. It's done well. It's executed well. The artist is certainly very talented. And why can't we praise that work? We see it in the music industry. We value the original composition. That piece of paper does have value, but we listen to how it was rendered by other orchestras, and we appreciate it. We don't really do that with the visual arts. There's almost this over-focus on the original work, and forgeries tend not to be appreciated. But forgeries serve a purpose. A lot of great art is locked up in the homes of collectors. They go into vaults, and no one can see them. And when that happens, and that's a shame, you know, forgeries can play a valuable role in allowing everyone else to enjoy a great artwork.
Talk about the difference in attitudes about forgeries between museums on the one side and private collectors on the other.
Well, I think most people do want the original artwork. It's just much too expensive. Some people would like a forgery because they like to play jokes on people. You know, there was a collector apparently in Tennessee who has two Van Goghs and wanted a third that was a forgery, and he would play, you know, tricks with people. You identify the real thing or identify the fake. But forgeries are valuable. We can learn a lot from a forgery.
Talk a little bit about what we can learn from a forgery. What does it teach us?
Well, for the art world, it teaches dealers and even collectors to look at the art itself. One of the things I found out in the book while researching was that priorities tend to shift back and forth in the art world. Who painted a work sometimes takes more precedence than how the artwork looks. Dealers pay a lot of attention to who owned it, who painted it, where it was exhibited, and that often clouds their judgment. They may have doubts about the artwork, but they'll look at the paperwork and they'll think, oh, well, the work must be okay. The paperwork is good. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at the art anymore. And we can look at art in two ways. And one way is we can look at art for its intrinsic merit. I mean, it's beautiful, therefore we like it. It inspires us. It brings something noble out in us, and that's the purpose of art. But there are some people who also look at art as a collectible, and that's strictly, you know, for its financial value. A collector might buy a work not because he or she likes the work, but because it fills out their collection. It's that one little golden nugget they need. Right. And they're not looking at the painting anymore. Hmm. And that's what's important. And some people question why a Giacometti painting that was done poorly by Giacometti should be worth more than a painting by an artist who is alive and does a great job on a piece of work.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this forgery, this forger, John Drew, who you write about, that basically was engaged in these forgeries for about 10 years between the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s.
Well, John Drew is a con man, and he understood that, I mean, I assume he understood that, you know, the art world is a world that is based on trust and honesty. It's not very regulated and it's not very transparent. So it is ripe for abuse. And he became partners with a very talented painter named John Myatt. And through sort of a long, you know, almost a two-year relationship with John Myatt, he sort of groomed John Myatt to be willing to cross the line and to start painting forgeries knowingly and to help John Drew sell them on the market.
How many paintings were involved here?
The police aren't exactly sure how many were involved, but John Myatt has said that he is pretty sure he remembers that he painted about 240 works for John Drew.
Mm-hmm.
And the police have recovered about 75 of those works.
And these were works representing what artists?
They were considered modern masters. There was a wide range of them. John Myatt was very talented, and he studied every artist he forged. There was Alberto Giacometti, his paintings, Graham Sutherland. There were some Brocks, Chagall's, Le Corbusier, Clay, Glez. There were a lot, about 35 artists John Myatt says he's painted.
And talk about the quality of the work, the quality of the forgeries that John Meyer did, and were they consistently the same across all of these artists, or were some of them particularly better than others?
Some were better than others, and for John Meyer, it had less to do with the artist that he was forging. It had to do with how he was doing at the time psychologically. He had sort of a love-hate relationship with this con game with John Drew.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, he loved it, and he was having a great time. He needed the money. When he met John Drew, he was a single father trying to support two kids. He was at risk of his children being taken away by social services simply because he wasn't making enough money. He was a very worried man. And one of the reasons why we tell the book through his eyes is because there's nothing psychopathic about John Myatt. He's actually, at heart, a very honest person. And he kind of is an example of the vulnerability we all can have.
Mm-hmm.
If we have our backs pushed up against the wall and we come across a con man. So in the beginning, his artworks, you know, he was fine with it. And he says the paintings were very good. But then as he started to have doubts about what he was doing, and he started to feel guilty, and he started to look in the mirror and realize that he was committing a crime, that there were victims to this crime, the paintings became worse. And, you know, he even admits that some were just abysmally bad, and he couldn't believe that they were approved by experts and dealers in the art market.
Talk about that, how these experts and dealers were so easily fooled by these paintings.
It had to do a lot with John Drew's provenances. With many artworks, each artwork is supposed to come with a paper trail, and that shows the origin of the work, when it was painted, by whom, who the first buyer was, often there might be a catalog from an exhibition that might go along with that, receipts, titles. If the work has been mentioned in any books or magazines, that will go into the provenance. So Drew was very adept at forging papers, and at one point he even managed to steal some archives that had some of the letterhead from some galleries. So he would make up receipts, credible receipts. He understood through research who might have collected some of these original works that John Maya was painting, and came up with a paper trail. And what John Drew did that was different from all the other art crimes so far is that he then conned his way into the archives and managed to slip these documents into the archives so that when a dealer did have doubts and did due diligence on his research, they'd go to the archives and find the paperwork there and then think, gosh, you know, Giacometti must have been having a bad day. This work is authentic. Here it is in the gallery books. It must be real.
And what was John Drew's history before this particular con?
He's a bit of a mystery. There's about a 10-year gap, 10 to 15-year gap, where the police really can't quite identify where he was and what he was doing. We do know that he was teaching for a while at some, you know, the equivalent of a high school with false credentials. He walked around London claiming that he had a Ph.D. in nuclear physics. Told many people he worked for an atomic energy authority, that he was consulting for the Ministry of Defense, that he was a spy, that he worked for Mossad. He had many different personas, but none of them checked out when the police looked him up.
Right. And how was this con unraveled ultimately?
I think it was just critical mass was one reason. Dealers started to realize that they kept seeing too many mediocre works with stellar provenances, and the provenances started to look familiar as well. The same collectors kept coming up. There was a commonality, I guess, among the provenances, and that alerted their attention. John Drew did many things with his provenances. There was always an exhibition catalog. There were labels at the back from galleries of the works, and they started noticing that. So a few called the police, but the police didn't really act on these phone calls until John Drew's ex-partner, whom he was living with, they broke up their relationship, and they had two kids. And she, sort of as a way of revenge and to protect herself, found three garbage bags filled of documents in the attic of the house that they shared, and knew that something was up. She wasn't quite sure whether it was a forgery scam or an art ring that was selling stolen works, and she brought those to the police.
How much money was involved here?
No one really knows. I mean, in the court case, it was claimed that he made about £1 million. But in my opinion, just given my conversations with John Drew and with the dealers, and how many artworks are actually still out there, I think he made much more.
Talk a little bit about those conversations with John Drew and your impressions of him.
He's actually a fascinating person to speak with on the phone. I actually, you know, I enjoyed my conversations with him. He has a very mellifluous voice, a very mesmerizing voice, and a very beautiful accent. It's almost sort of a purr as he talks. But it was very difficult, for me at least, to stay in control of the conversation. I would ask a question, and invariably his answers would digress. He was good with the art of conversational swerve, and I could never quite bring him back to where I wanted him to be. And he would always claim that what he was talking about was relevant, but I was never satisfied with the answer. And to this day, I'm not too sure if that's just his nature or if he was doing it on purpose to bamboozle me or to put me off the trail. John Drew strikes me as a person who has been inventing so many stories all his life that in a way I think he's lost his own center. I in my opinion he's a pathological liar, and pathological liars just they tend to tell lies even when they don't have to. There's no external gain, but they do it for some inner drive.
Right. Tell us a little bit about who the victims were in these cons.
The victims were, I mean, the dealers for sure. Many dealers lost money on these works. They never got their money back after buying the fake when they couldn't sell them. The runners who were selling works on Drew's behalf unwittingly, they didn't know they were fakes. They lost a lot of money to Drew. Sometimes Drew would borrow money from them and then as collateral give them a work. And the runner would be confident because they would see it was a Brock and say, oh, well, I know I can get, you know, this is worth $100,000, you know, but of course it's a fake, so it's not worth anything. I mean, I think with a con man, you know, the biggest price people pay is sort of loss of trust in themselves. I mean, it's very unnerving when you've been the victim of a con. Mm-hmm. We all believe that we have enough common sense to protect ourselves from people like this, but we always look at cons from the outside in, not from the inside out. And to know that you can be this vulnerable to someone over a long period of time is quite scary. And you tend to start to distrust the people around you. And con men actually are around us all over, and they tend to be people we know.
Were there dealers along the way that knew this was a con, just instinctively or based on the painting or based on the documentation, and were willing to go along with it anyway because there was money to be made for them?
I mean, I think all the dealers I spoke with are honest. You know, there was one dealer who to this day, even though he knows that the work he bought is a fake, he loves it and he wants it back. And I think that's a great attitude to have. He thinks it's a beautiful work and the police have it still, but he wants it back. He thinks it's worth something and that's just the beauty of it. You know, again, this is a profession that is based on a lot of it is based on trust and honesty, and I think there are a lot of dealers out there who are honest, but there are the bad few who give it a bad name. I do think that there are dealers out there who are given a work and they are suspicious of it, but it's good enough that they do pass it on. And I was surprised by that because I always thought that dealers were the guardians of the art world for the purity of art, to keep it pure. But these people have high overheads. They're in a risky business, and it's a tough business, and they're dealing with some of the wealthiest people in the world, and I think it's quite difficult to cry fake when you come across a fake. You uh-huh. could be libeled, you could be sued, and you could be out of a business.
What about on the museum side?
I think they also try their best to make sure that the works they receive and buy are genuine. I mean, they're the keepers of art history and cultural patrimony, I guess, so to speak. There's the, you know, the Paul Getty Museum out in California. There's sort of a popular story of they bought a Greek sculpture called a Kouros, and there was doubts about its authenticity, and they went as far as having an international conference on this sculpture to prove its authenticity. They paid $7 million for it, and they really wanted to know whether it was a fake or not. And to this day, people aren't sure. The anthropologists and the art experts say it's a fake. The scientists who've done forensics on the sculpture say it's genuine. So when you go there, there's a plaque next to the sculpture, and it says, you know, Greek Kouros, 530 BC, or modern forgery. You know, they're not too sure. But I think the John Drew, John Myatt con sort of brings up, for me at least, is that, you know, cons always dive in when there's money to be made. Forgeries always come out when there's money to be made. An artist's career skyrockets, his work or her work becomes valuable, then the forgers come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and sometimes I question how artwork is valued and why is it so expensive. And what I think is sad for the public and for museums is that they're getting priced out of the market, and the museums are the only place where, you know, the little people like us can go see a work, and they can't buy them because they're too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Does that in fact lead to more opportunities for these cons and for these kind of art forgeries that we talked about at the outset, that in fact they're more prevalent than we think, and part of that arguably comes from the fact that so many people are really priced out of the market?
Yes, I mean, forgers come out when when something is valuable. And it's with art or with a pair of jeans or bags or watches. Mm-hmm. When people start paying a lot of money and perhaps too much money for the actual value of the object, people are going to start doing knockoffs in the hopes that they'll make some money off of it too. So that, you know, it happens in every industry.
Tell us a little about how the police responded to this, how law enforcement and Scotland Yard in particular responded.
In the beginning, they weren't quite sure what kind of case they had. They weren't sure if it was a forgery case or if it was a stolen artwork case. And I think, like many cities, except for in Italy, where there's a big art crime police force, art crime tends to take a back seat to all the other crimes. Some police forces think that, you know, collectors can afford to be conned. You know, they can afford to lose the millions of dollars. That's all right. Or the museums can. So they don't seem to take it as seriously as other crimes. So the art squad in Britain at the time had only about, I think it was three other officers. And they were busy on another case that had to do with a scandal where a British dealer was smuggling Egyptian artwork into the country and then selling them off illegally. And they were working on that case. So there was one lone detective who was trying to piece together this con. And John Drew is not an easy man to follow. You know, he does leave a trail of lies behind him. So, you know, it took the one police officer about a year just to figure out what was going on and to realize that this was a forgery case and that all the documents he was looking at were forged. And that the paintings, that he had photographs of the paintings, that those were forged too. And then he sort of went through a long, slow process of piecing together all the paperwork with all the paintings and following the trail. And he was a very big help in writing the book too, because my husband and I just kept getting bogged down in all these red herrings that Drew would set out, mm-hmm. and dead ends, and there were names of people who didn't exist, or he would switch last names with first names, and it got very confusing. And you know, the cop just kept telling us, he just said, keep it simple. You know, you just have to focus on one part of it, ignore the rest, and then you'll see the web.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. And there's parts of this con that we couldn't even look into because it was too complicated. And same with the police. They had to put on the blinders, because there were so many side cons that John Drew couldn't help but do. They couldn't afford to follow them, or the whole case would be at risk of falling apart.
And Myatt, once this thing came to light, how did he respond?
By the time Myatt ended up getting out of the con, because there was a point where it seemed that John Drew was getting out of control. Again, I don't know if that was on purpose on his part or if it was natural. But John Myatt wanted to get out, and he felt trapped, and he couldn't get out. And he did manage to get out, but the police still ended up knocking on his door. And he decided to help the police. I think he feared for his life. He was worried that John Drew might come after him. And the safest thing was to help the police try and catch him.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what was the punishment to John Drew?
He was sentenced to 6 years. He was found guilty, and he served four of those.
And what is he doing now? Do we know?
Not really. I mean, I spoke with him. He told me that he's filing patents for a lot of it had to do with military defense equipment. He claimed he had a meeting set up with the Pentagon, and he was going to meet with representatives of them pretty soon. He still claims that he's a nuclear physicist working in a lab, working on inventions.
Lainey Salisbury, the book is Provenance, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art. It's just out from Penguin Press. Lainey, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thanks very much.